Welcome to a special episode of Future Makers, our first recorded live, where we'll be taking questions from our wonderful audience here in the Nelson Mandela Theatre at Oxford Saïd Business School. If you've been listening to our podcast since the beginning, you'll know that we've already covered two huge fields of research that may have a dramatic influence on our future: artificial intelligence and quantum computing. In this special episode, we're returning to some of the key questions debated in those episodes. In particular, the automation of jobs through AI. How is it already affecting the way we work? Where is it heading? And what should society do about it? Algorithmic bias. How prevalent is it? What impact is it having? And again, what should we do about it? Propaganda, misinformation, user manipulation. How fundamental a difference has been made by new technology? And can AI help to provide a solution? And finally, looking to the future, are there any serious existential risks arising from the development of AI, especially when that exceeds human performance across a wide range? With me to discuss these issues today and to respond to questions from our audience at the Oxford AI Conference are Professor Mike Wooldridge, head of Oxford's Department of Computer Science, who was also a panelist on our ninth episode around the progression of AI in China. Dr. Safia Noble, Associate Professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and author of the best-selling book, Algorithms of Oppression: How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. Mitchell Baker, Chairwoman of Mozilla, who's highly regarded as one of the pioneers of the web and bringing the open internet to consumers. And Jim Wilkinson, Chief Financial Officer of Oxford Sciences Innovation, a group that's invested in over 40 spin-outs from the University of Oxford. A warm welcome to you all. Okay, so Mike, if I can start with you. Automation of jobs, how is it already affecting things? Where's it heading? What should we do about it?
So this is not an original observation, but it's nevertheless true, so I'll repeat it. I mean, automation of jobs is nothing new. However many thousand years ago, somebody invented the plough, and somebody had the idea of putting oxen in front of that plough, and in a sense, that started putting people out of work. I mean, what that actually did, and it's important to remember this, is it didn't replace farmers, it just made them more efficient farmers. But the automation of labour has just been progressing ever since then. The current kind of fourth wave, or whatever you want to call it, follows on from the end of the 1970s, when I remember there was regular discussion after the invention of the microprocessor and the idea that the microprocessor was going to be start widely used, the idea that we would all be in kind of only need to work 3 days a week and the rest of the time we would be reading Plato or climbing mountains or whatever it was we did with our spare time. And the current discussion about AI, I think, has exactly the same tone. So, firstly, automation of labour is nothing new. It's part of a very, very old, ongoing trend. How does it affect us now? Okay, so the interesting thing is right now, where I think we will see this most obviously are in jobs where AI starts to be our boss. So you have an algorithm as a boss, and there are very well-documented case studies. For example, in the warehouses of large online retailers, where people's day-to-day role is managed down at a second-by-second level, and they are told down to minute detail what they should be doing moment by moment. And the first thing to say is I'm as much worried about that prospect, the idea of AI being our boss, as I am about the idea of AI replacing jobs. And I think that's a much less well-known aspect of the AI phenomenon, but I think is an extremely important one. There's a well-known AI scientist, Andrew Ng, used to be head of the AI lab at Stanford University, one of the world's great AI centers. And he's great at soundbites. And one of his soundbites was, any decision you can make in 1 second, we can automate with AI. Actually, that's a huge range of decisions can be automated right now with AI. And over the next decades, we will see that kind of that decision making rolled out. So I think AI is going to play a larger and larger role. But the important point, it isn't just replacing jobs. Yes, it will. I'm not scared about a future where we won't have jobs. I think there will be jobs. There'll be plenty of jobs in the future. But I think the nature of work will change as well. And I think that's part of the narrative that we're not quite hearing right now.
Thank you. Sophia.
Well, you know, I think that people have also always outsourced labor to someone else. And so when we think about automation in particular, I don't think it's just limited to thinking about AI as a tool, but the whole set of labor and work practices that are a part of the development of machine learning algorithms and their implementation. So for example, you know, we might think of Uber or Lyft as a kind of new innovation that uses machine learning to better match customers with people who can transport them somewhere. But the labor of driving hasn't gone anywhere, and the labor of making automobiles and other transportation systems, roads, all of the things that are necessary. What has happened, though, is I think the narrative about, let's say, software applications that overlay labor is particularly glamorous. It's helped extract hundreds of millions, dare I say billions of dollars, into the hands of some. And it's also eroded the quality of work and labor for many people. And so now you're no longer a taxi driver that has, let's say, workplace protections, healthcare, other types of benefits. You are a gig worker that has kind of this, you know, unnuanced way of thinking about your work as being gig and creative, but is actually precarious and under-supported and under-resourced. So I think the questions are really, to what degree does AI and some of the hype about AI exacerbate the extraction of our labor and consolidate that into the hands of a few? And those are the questions that to me are quite interesting to ask and to kind of put on the table. It's not so much that, and let me just say again, human beings have always outsourced the parts of the labor they don't want to do to other people with less power. So the question is, to what degree is AI, masking that process? Will it make more visible those processes and help us think about the distribution of resources with the labor that we do?
Thank you. Mitchell.
Well, I'll be the voice for more change faster, perhaps. I think both the software overlay on labor, but the actual labor itself, what actually is a machine, an automated machine, a robot, an AI-driven machine, you know, anywhere in that progression capable of doing. And I think, you know, assuming no global disaster, climate or otherwise, so assuming technological progress continues, I think the next 25 to 50 years are going to see wild and dramatic changes in what requires human labor. It will be very interesting. You know, places, China is the example of often using human labor where it's cheap, where here in this part of the world we don't do that. But you see that AI moving in China as well. So I think the types of work that can be done by machines, smart or otherwise, or directed by smart machines, will just explode. And so then the question becomes the social and political environment in which it lives in. Because, you know, in the Industrial Revolution, there was also a system where every worker worked piecemeal and couldn't get up and get a drink of water, couldn't go to the bathroom. You know, like, everything was regulated with the technology they had then, which was human. So we've been through these systems before, but in general, the complexity of the technology is such, I think it's overwhelming our ability to think about the social and political aspects of it.
Thank you. Jim?
I think AI has to be put in the context of the rest of the technological change that's going on at the moment, from quantum through all the changes that are happening in health. And we've been through these sort of changes before, and I sort of reminded back of the Industrial Revolution, where the thought process was that at the end of that, people would actually be better off. As a population, we were, but as individuals, it was actually very difficult. quite a lot of people weren't better off, and certainly quality of life wasn't. This change is going to happen. I think it's quite dangerous to think of AI purely in isolation away from everything else that's going to happen over the next 30 years. So I kind of think that we should accept what's going on, but then try to put the controls around as it happens to make sure that we end up in a state where we have got a higher quality of life. And I particularly look forward to working 3 days a week and having the other four off.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to algorithmic bias. And by the way, do be thinking about the questions that you would like to pose when your opportunity comes soon. Mike, algorithmic bias.
So this is a real thing. And I think the issues around bias are one of, I mean, I'm now putting my kind of scientist hat on, so apologies, it sounds rather geeky, but just from a purely scientific perspective, the way that those issues have sort of risen in prominence over the last few years and suddenly have presented us with a whole range of challenges that we just didn't know were there, I think is really, really fascinating. Algorithmic bias, I think there is a bit of a debate about whether it's algorithmic bias or data bias. And actually, data bias, I think, is by far the more pernicious challenge there. And there is just this incredible wealth of evidence now that all sorts of data sets that we use that have just become part and parcel of everyday life in the AI community, that are routinely used by the AI community for training their machine learning software, are just riddled with bias. Because when they were constructed, these issues were just not well understood. And these things are difficult to construct. They're difficult, they're expensive, they're very, very time consuming to construct. Good data sets to do with images, good data sets to do with voice and so on, they're not easy to come by. And so people do tend to grab the sort of the nearest one. But the evidence is overwhelming. There is a groundswell now of opinion within the community that these are issues that need to be grappled. I'm sure you guys must have seen on social media yesterday the ImageNet software. You could put a picture of yourself in ImageNet and then see the labels that it came back with. And ImageNet is famous within the AI community as being the most famous data set there was. It's the one that drove the AI captioning revolution in around about 2012. And the results are pretty shocking, actually, to see. It comes back with some terms that you simply would not get away with using in polite society. I mean, that's putting it very, very mildly. So there's a great reference for this, a book called Invisible Women, which documents in exhausting detail the bias that's implicit just completely, not throughout just AI, but actually throughout technology. The good news is, I think there is a genuine willingness to address these issues, but we're right at the beginning of understanding, how do we construct data sets that are free of bias and that are diverse and so on. We're right at the beginning of that, and the danger is, if you have some company that doesn't have people trained, they know about the AI, but they don't understand these diversity issues, they build their systems and it is just riddled with the same biases.
Thank you. Sophia, I'm sure you'll have a lot to say on this.
I feel like since I wrote a book called Algorithms of Oppression, I have a thought or two about it. The challenge is absolutely true about kind of the social construction of data, which is not a way that typically computer scientists think about data, the kind of lob off, let's say, the social construction part, or maybe that isn't part of the kind of fundamental way that people think about data. In information studies where I work, we teach our graduate students and our undergraduates about the ways in which data is made. And of course, that is a purely subjective kind of series of processes. They're tied to methodologies. Data is often an abstraction from something that is very specific and nuanced. And when you start stripping away the specificity and the nuance, let's say, of a person, and you start trying to aggregate people and then make meaning of what that group might represent, every level of these kinds of constructions of data are ripe for opportunity to get it wrong. So we know that that is happening. I think one of the problems, though, is that we've started to flatten this conversation about bias to say things, and I hear this all the time at all kinds of gatherings, everything is biased, everyone is biased, we all hold biases. But see, when we talk about, and by we, I mean those of us who are kind of critical information studies scholars talk about bias, we're talking about things like systemic discrimination, historical patterns of marginalization, and how data gets used to reinforce that or instantiate that or make that more real. So it's not abstracted outside of a social or political or economic context. That, I think, is really important because it's really insufficient to say, well, all data is biased, you know, toward the blondes or the brunettes, when if that isn't the basis of historical discrimination or marginalization, then that may or may not really be a very valuable kind of analytic. The questions of bias are really tied to fundamental systems of social, political, and economic oppression or liberation or possibility or opportunity. And that is the context within which I think we need to be thinking about what is bias. It's one of the reasons why sometimes we use other kinds of frameworks like technological redlining or data discrimination. Those are actually, I think, different. They invoke different kinds of models of thinking about what is data and how does it get used in service of those kinds of problems. And I think that would be a more nuanced way to think about things like bias.
Thank you. Mitchell.
Well, I think rather than try to add, maybe I'll take a slightly different approach and say there's also the structural bias, I would say, about time. And depending on how long it takes to construct a data set, what the data set is. And so one open question is if or as machine learning decision making becomes the foundation of larger parts of decision making by institutions, how do we represent our aspirations? So we'll take bias, we can use the word bias now, but you know, a lot of this is based on outright discrimination. So in many ways and in many places, this discrimination is illegal now in ways it wasn't illegal in the past. But the data sets are from the past. And so we aspire to something better. How does that get reflected? And that, I think, is a computer science problem. It's a social problem. And it's going to be a problem in life for all of us. So in many ways, I think they'll say the racial or gender discrimination is a clear example. Some of this stuff was really legal in the past. But it's not now. And yet, it's. I'm not even sure how it's legal to use a bunch of these machine learning-based processes like mortgage lending when you know it's discriminatory. Like, I don't actually understand how we can actually legally put them into practice, but it appears one can. But even if we can solve those problems, this question of time and how do we reflect the aspirations that we want to be? You know, in humans, it's uneven, right? You can't actually tell how much a human being is actually changing our own decision-making to reflect something we aspire to. But it's an even more black box question, I think, in this machine learning world.
Thank you. Jim?
I find, I think in the introduction, I'm an investor in lots of companies, some of which are AI, but I'm not an expert in AI, as you've probably guessed. What I find here is that it's a typical attitude from mathematicians and computer scientists that you can get to perfection. I'd love to think that we can, and I think actually with this sort of technology, maybe we stand a chance of it. But the world is a very complex place. There are all sorts of conscious and unconscious biases, and that's bound to be reflected in the output that we're seeing. I think the really interesting bit is what we can do about it in terms of diversity, in terms of finding out where we've got biases and then dealing with them. And perhaps AI can actually help us solve that problem.
Thank you. You want to say something?
Yeah. So this was doing the rounds on social media yesterday. And so I urge you to, on your way home, go and have a look at it. It's called ImageNet Roulette. And it uses the data set called ImageNet, which was created, Fei-Fei Li started this in Stanford University around about a decade ago. And it's the most famous data set in the machine learning community. And roughly speaking, what it is hundreds of thousands of images which are labeled
which have been manually labeled with categories. And so all that ImageNet Roulette does is you upload a picture of yourself and it finds the best match picture for you on the ImageNet database and tells you what labels are used to label that picture. Now, if you search for ImageNet Roulette on social media, you'll find lots of outraged stories. I urge you to try it with a diverse group of friends. And it's just an incredibly vivid illustration of entirely innocent, this wasn't, you know, ill-intentioned, entirely innocent bias that's implicit in the most famous and probably most important data set that we have right now. It's quite eye-opening.
Thank you. Now, I'm eager to get to audience questions before long, and our introductory discussion is taking a bit longer than expected. So I'm going to invite each of you in turn to speak on one of the two topics, propaganda, misinformation, user manipulation, or existential risks. And hopefully a couple of you may go on each. Propaganda, misinformation?
One of the areas in which machine learning is in play in the background is obviously in social media and in the business aspect of, you know, personalization and monetization of content. And so I think it's not generally understood, you know, the granular nature of information about each one of us and the ability to target. Sometimes it's gotten wrapped up in this word privacy, which I think is too small actually to cover the scope of issues. And then the tracking and creepiness, but increasingly moving to know enough about you to be able to encourage, promote behavior, i.e. manipulate. And not just the click to buy, but the be out in the street, be outraged, you know, move into that sort of mob mentality part of life, you know, that outraged piece. And so that's a piece where the misinformation, spreads, it turns out, as humans. And we, you know, we respond to fear and anger in somewhat predictable ways. And so that also turns out to be engagement metrics. So we've built a system, we have today these systems based on engagement metrics in which outrageous content, true or not, is what people engage with the most, it seems. So one of the issues there is we have these massive systems with data, very personal data, and the ability to test, really all aimed at us. And so one of the questions is, where and how do we get machine, we'll say AI, you know, but really working with us aimed back out? It's all one direction right now. All the power, not just the data, but the power and the ability to deploy machine learning systems in information processes is owned by a few, aimed at us, with particular, you know, engagement metrics in mind. And so one of the things, we don't have a solution yet, it's partly why I'm here and I love to be at the AI and Oxford piece, is, you know, at Mozilla, we are trying to figure out what would it look like to have AI that's working for me and that's aimed back out in the world. Because there's clearly a set of people who must like the outrageous materials, but there's also a lot of us who would prefer something more reflective, but get caught up. So that's an area where I don't actually know of a lot. I probably investments and companies trying, but we haven't gotten very far as an industry or an academic space yet.
Yeah, I'd love to add to that if I may.
Yeah, do.
Because it just, before we go in a new direction, part of what's challenging with this process is the speed and scale at which the propaganda and disinformation also can flourish. We've always had propaganda and disinformation in many societies, but the speed and scale and the rapidity at which that can be disseminated, and of course, these are not just individual experiences of content, let's say, engagement. If you are a part of a community that is targeted with propaganda or disinformation, of course, I'm African American, I live in the United States, I'm part of a community that is targeted by white nationalists, white supremacists, and people who are who engage with content that would, in fact, do things like disrupt a presidential election. And also foment an incredible increase in hate crimes, and racist hate crimes specifically. So I think the challenge here is that our framing is also about kind of our personal engagements, because so much of the way we come into contact with misinformation and disinformation and propaganda is personal, but it actually has kind of, again, a cumulative community-wide kinds of effects. If you are, for example, in harm's way of that propaganda, or you're the subject of targeting from that disinformation. And that is where a place where we don't have a lot of protections, we don't have proper regulations, we don't really have very many rights to speak back to you, those kinds of processes that are happening too.
I mean, I hate to say it, but I actually think the answer to this is going to end up being regulation. And I know information at the moment is very different to comparing with the newspaper world. That newspapers were regulated, there's things they could say or couldn't say. At the moment, the information is small, bite-sized, in multiple places, and it's completely opaque. You can't see where it's coming from. The only way to control that, I think, is going to end up being regulation of some sort or another.
Thank you. Mike, it falls to you to say something about existential risk.
So I guess the podcast has a kind of family audience, so I shouldn't swear. Despite the fact that I have a very great temptation to do so when people talk about existential risk. I think we need to move on from that narrative. It's a kind of a lazy headline for press. Whenever there's a story about AI in the press, you know, they always have the kind of the Terminator. Oh my God, I just said Terminator. I'm sorry. They always have that kind of Terminator type picture there. There are many things I lose sleep about. I lose sleep about my Oxford mortgage. I lose sleep about climate change. I lose sleep about the end of fossil fuels. I really lose sleep about nuclear weapons. I mean, those are things that we should be losing sleep about. And I could, if I had time to think, I could probably give you another 10 that you should worry about before the AI, AI taking over and destroying us all. AI is one part, one tiny thread in a huge tapestry of changes, industrial changes, sociological changes, political changes. It's one tiny thread. The future is uncertain. Who knows what the world is going to be like in 100 years? And the space of possibilities is way too broad to be confident. But let me ask you this, and I didn't come up with this analogy. This is due to Rod Brooks. Okay, so think about super intelligent machines. Firstly, the idea that somebody would find a magic switch that would make machines super intelligent, I just don't buy into at all. I think that I just don't see any, that's just not going to happen. I mean, I cannot be absolutely certain about that, but in the terms of probabilities, it just seems incredibly unlikely. We've been looking for 60 years and we have found no magic switch. There is no magic switch. So what's the alternative? The alternative is that somebody spends a huge amount of time and money building a super intelligence. It's not going to take us by surprise, and it's not going to happen overnight. So the analogy due to Rod Brooks, think of superintelligence as being a Boeing 747. Did the origin of a Boeing 747 take us by surprise? Did somebody invent it in their garden shed? No, of course they didn't. And in exactly the same way, I just think it's highly unlikely that, this kind of superintelligence is going to take over. I could be wrong. But actually, in terms of probabilities, I think, I will sleep easy, at least with respect to existential risk from AI tonight. There are just more important things that we should be worrying about, in my view.
Thank you very much.
So my thanks again to Mike,
Sophia, Mitchell and Jim for taking part in what's been a fascinating and wide-ranging discussion today. To our audience for such excellent and thought-provoking questions. And of course, to you at home for listening. If you've enjoyed this discussion today, please do us a favour and tell a friend about the podcast. We want to inspire as many discussions on the future of AI as we can. I'm Peter Milliken, and thank you for listening to Future Makers. That's it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.